Concludes this evening's episode of Too True, the dance music show on K-Chung Radio. And now, no more music.
Uns is over.
Yeah, no more pleasures of the body. Now it is time for pleasures of the mind. Because you are listening to The Talking Show on K-Chung Radio, Chinatown's only micro-broadcasting radio
station. That's us.
I'm Nicholas Miller. I'm here, as always, with the inimitable and unflagging, unflappable, and nearly departed Steve Cato.
Well, don't, you know, I'm going to come back every day.
That's true. We did, negotiated. Steve got a good gig out there in Austin, and we negotiated a contract to have him flown back by the Union Jet once a week.
Bernie Sanders. Specifically launched the Union green airline that I fly on.
Elizabeth Warren is against the whole plan, so you know exactly who to vote for, talking show listeners.
All the time. Only Bernie.
Yeah. Although, we won't have a new president by the time you get back, right?
No. Well, yeah. Yeah. No. That's right. It'll be September 20. Yeah, no, no. Yeah. So it'll be in November. I'll be here for the election.
Yeah. Way to go.
Wow. Mm-hmm. Another fun time I can have.
It's going to be a humdinger.
Watching Donald Trump become the president of America twice.
Mm-hmm. How was your week, Steve?
You know, fine. We did some renovations on the place.
Your apartment?
Yeah. It's funny because you'd think that if you were going out of town,
just leave it as is
and deal with it later, but no, we're dealing with it now, I guess. So our shower had been, the walls had been buckling in, I think, from inappropriate moisture, making it to inappropriate places in the wall.
Hmm.
And so they tore out the walls today.
Who's they?
Oh, the landlord's men.
Oh, okay. So you didn't renovate the place.
No, no, no. But, I mean, like...
Does the landlord know you're leaving?
No. And the workmen come in and out and the cats get out. So we have to stay in.
Mm.
Or someone has to be at home to, like, gather the cats.
I see.
And such. So... And also just, like, you know, like, the workmen actually ask a lot of questions. Like, they're kind of good at their job. You know, like, they're, like... like this or like that, you know, what would you like, you know? Mm-hmm, and we're like, oh, we have opinions, so it's good to have someone around. So it's been a weird week. Our bathroom's been torn apart. We're fortunately cat sitting for a neighbor of ours, so we shower at her house.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, wild. Not what I thought would happen, you know?
No. Are you packing up?
We're working on it. Meredith still has a lot of stuff to pack up, I don't mind saying.
Yeah. Are you, what are you doing with your studio?
We're using it as a storage unit.
Okay, because it's pretty affordable.
It's very cheap.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Perfect. Well, you got it. It sounds like you got a good plan.
Anything that's going to be fine. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
How are you doing? How's your week?
It was fine. I think I had jury duty this week.
Was that this week?
That was last week.
Yeah.
Yeah. I also...
But the trauma is still fresh.
Oh, it's lightning fresh. It's air freshener fresh. Mm. This week, I don't know. I've just been in Renderland all week.
Oh. What have you been rendering? What kind of objects?
A lot of jewelry.
Okay.
And a building.
Oh, cool.
Mm-hmm. An architect's new studio.
Oh, congratulations.
Yeah, that's been fun. Although there are many more things to think about in an entire building than there is in a piece of jewelry.
It's like just because it's bigger.
Many more. Yeah, many more things. More surfaces, more different, more objects, right. More materials.
So do you feel like you're a little over your head?
No, it's just, I've gotten very fast at modeling small objects.
Oh, sick.
Just not so fast at modeling something that's big. Also, reading, like a proper, this guy's a very good architect.
Mm.
And like, I can tell like his architectural plans are quite tight and good.
Mm.
But that doesn't mean I know how to interpret them well.
Right.
So there's been like several startovers where you're like, oh, okay. So
I did this wrong.
From this floor to this floor, there's a 4-inch step up, but that changes everything.
Yeah.
Like all the doors have to be raised 4 inches. You know, like everything has to go up 4 inches. But then you're like, well, but then when you exit that room into the patio, is the patio at that? Do you step down?
Or do you, yeah, yeah.
Maybe this is not true for all architectural plans, but this one, like many of the measurements are very clear and precise. But then I feel like every page has like two dimensions where you're like, but how far is that door from that wall? Why isn't that there? You're like, am I missing something? But
so like one dimension that's absent.
Yeah. And then what usually happens is every complex interaction, like a door or like a sink or something, has a detail page like 60 pages later in the document.
Right.
And that dimension will be there. But right. Then like you're drawing and you're like flipping back and forth to this like 100 page, and you know, it's printed like this big.
Yeah.
It's like a giant comic book.
Yeah.
So I don't know. I'm just getting used to like looking at all those different elevations and stuff and envisioning the building.
It's your first architectural gig?
Yeah.
Congratulations.
Yeah. Yeah. Should be fun. Make it look real.
Make it look easy.
Yeah, exactly. Well, speaking of easy, tonight we have a professor to discuss an experience I went through last week that was certainly not easy for me. It didn't seem easy for any other parties involved, but hopefully Professor Paul Zweier will make it a bit easier for everyone. So everyone, put your ears together for Dr. Paul Zweier.
What in the world are you supposed to do with jury selection? How in the world do you get a handle on the complex set of skills that are important for talking and selecting jurors that'll be right for the State versus Mitchell case? Well, let me give you some tips and some suggestions about ways to think about what it is that you're doing. And so let me talk about, first of all, the purpose of jury selection and talk to you about some theories that are out there about that, and then give you some specific skills that I hope you'll see integrate these different purposes into a set of tasks that you have to perform as you do the jury selection exercise. Jury selection, of course, is called voir dire, jury voir dire. Voir dire is to speak the truth. And the idea is that jurors are supposed to be sworn to tell you the truth for the purpose of your trying to figure out whether they'll be fair jurors for the case. And so we'll talk in just a minute about how it is that you get started and how it is that you describe what it is that you're doing. But one way to think about your task is to say, how do I make sure that I've got jurors out there that don't have experiences in their lives that are going to make it very difficult for them to be able to hear the case that I'm presenting and to be able to hear the fair thing to do because of biases or prejudices or experiences that they may have. Now, you know, in the old days, one of the ways that lawyers dealt with jurors and jury selection is that because they were so closely connected to the communities in which they worked, they would often have lunch with these jurors. They knew where they went to church. They knew where it is that they lived. They knew what organizations they belonged to. They knew how they thought about the world, because literally part of the trial lawyer's expertise was to know the members of the community, know how it is that the community was reacting to various things. It was a small enough community that selecting jurors was an art based upon the expertise of a lawyer who knew the community and knew it very, very well. And the task for us as modern trial lawyers is much more difficult. Number one, we're getting into court many fewer times. But number two, our connection to our jurors, our closeness to our jurors, our knowledge of our jurors is much more difficult for us to be able to get into because our communities often are very much apart from each other. And so, you know, one question that we could ask is, as opposed to joining the country club and playing golf, should you be joining the bowling league, or should you be hanging out in places where your jurors are likely to come from for the purposes of really understanding how these jurors are going to see the world and to think? In the size of the communities that so many of us deal with, even then, knowing what these jurors think and how they feel and how they look at the world is a very uncertain process. Even if you hang out with them and even if you get to know the folks from the pool of jurors that your jurors are drawn from. So the purpose of the jury selection process is, in this impersonal world, how do you get to know about people's values? And how do you get to know about their experiences? Well, some have said that really you're not looking for fair jurors. What you're doing instead is, basically, you're looking for jurors who are for you, who already have experiences. You decide what those experiences would be that would make them predisposed to be for you. And a classic quick anecdote might make the point. You know, Dr. Kevorkian, Dr. Death, a number of years ago up in Michigan, was tried on 9 different occasions for attempted murder, for murder, for euthanasia, for a mercy killing is what he called it. And what we have is then a laboratory to try to look at what jurors are going to be sympathetic to a doctor who is not shy about the fact that he is helping somebody end their lives by administering some kind of a painkiller which has an effect of ending their life because they choose to do it. And the story is told that early on in these cases, in a focus group setting, one of the focus group members raised her hand early and said, you know, when I hear about Dr. Kevorkian, I keep thinking about an old dog. And this old dog was a dog that was suffering, and, you know, we put it to sleep. And the question, it seems to me, we have to ask ourselves is, if we do this for animals, and we think it's humane for animals, isn't it also fair to ask the question of whether or not it's something that we do for human beings when they're suffering? Well, you might imagine that story being told affected the trial lawyers for Dr. Kevorkian. And you know that in the first 8 cases, in the cases that he was not found guilty, the first question or one of the first questions in jury selection, as reported by David Ball, one of the jury consultants in these cases, was a question to the jurors, have any of you had an animal, a dog that you've ever had to put to sleep? And by drawing on that common experience, the argument is that experience could predispose now jurors in hearing about a case to think that, you know, Dr. Kevorkian should not be guilty of murder for what it is that he's doing. So in that theory, that approach, it's to try to find that experience. Where would you find those experiences? Well, boy, this is a place where you've got to really brainstorm. You've got to think about creatively about focus groups and trying to find out whether there are formative experiences. Presumably, we know from the O.J. Simpson cases that there are experiences that people have that could make them very much against you. Remember, in the O.J. Simpson case, the theory was is that the police officers were in a rush to judgment, that they were racist, and that they planted evidence. Well, if your experience in the Los Angeles community was that police officers did plant evidence, did lie, did convict individuals or help convict individuals because of their racial bias, then you can see that in that instance now you're not looking for jurors who are for you, you're looking for jurors who are against you. And you're trying to find out, if you were on the prosecution's team, what jurors had those kinds of experiences. How do you feel about police officers? What's your experience been with police officers? And your jury selection would try to find out those experiences and try to find ways to exclude jurors if they had those experiences. Now, so theories are often directed at these three things: finding fair jurors, finding jurors for you, finding jurors against you. And you need to know that a whole lot of courts have decided that because the time it would take really to find out about these experiences is time the court's not willing to give, that the court either takes over the purpose of voir dire by telling the jury, we're looking for you to be fair, and you tell us if you don't think you can be fair. We don't have the time unless we've got some pre-trial work done that's made a presentation to the court that shows there are particular kinds of experiences that need to be watched out for that's going to create an unfair bias. That what we're left with, if a court gives voir dire, it's often giving voir dire in a very limited basis, and trial lawyers today feel like that most of their time then needs to be spent protecting themselves from experiences jurors may have, biases that they may have, prejudices that they may have, that would predispose the jury against them and against their case. And so race is a topic of conversation. Race is important for the purposes of trying to determine whether or not individuals are biased and whether or not, in fact, they have prejudices against people of particular races. Being from not from this community, being an outsider, being somebody who has a education or a situation where they are predisposed against folks who have those kinds of qualifications, either for or against, is something that trial lawyers today tell us that they spend their time when they're given that limited opportunity. Now, for our purposes of discussion, we're going to assume a wide open voir dire. And for our purposes of discussion, we're going to assume that you are in a situation where you have a huge panel of folks and you're going to try to bring them into the box and you're going to try to create an environment where they're going to talk to you and they're going to share with you how they feel about the world, about the values that they have that help them either see this case one way or another. And we're going to allow you to go ahead and have conversations with jurors to do that. If you are restricted in that regard and you want to have that access, you're going to have to petition the court. Without that kind of permission granted, often courts will take over the process themselves. Maybe at the most they'll let you submit individual questions, but you may find that most courts today have restricted your jury selection down, way down. We're going to do it in a broad way because we want to give you an experience of what it would be like to voir dire in a situation where it's wide open and you get a chance to really explore the interests and biases and experiences that jurors may have. Well, what if you found a bias? What if you found a concern that would make you worry that the person might be against you? You need to know about two things. You need to know about peremptory challenges. In every jurisdiction, you're given a certain number of peremptory challenges. The peremptory challenges are often somewhere in the neighborhood of 6 to 10, and they'll give you a chance to go ahead and excuse jurors for the purpose of saying that, I just don't feel good about this person. And I would rather not have my client have to deal with that person. They're just not feeling right to me. Your peremptory challenges are on your choice based upon feelings that you get. Often those can be informed by a psychologist who can be sitting, watching as this thing goes on. Or They can be informed by an associate who's taking notes as you're having conversations. You'll see that one of the most difficult things that happens as a skill of jury selection is how do you keep track of what answers you're getting from what people, and then how do you make a good reasoned judgment about whether you ought to exercise a peremptory challenge or not. Now, the other kind of challenge is a challenge for cause. The challenge for cause is brought about when the jurors, in a sense, admit that it'd be very difficult for them to be fair. And we'll talk about the different skills that you're looking when you want your opponent to at least exercise a peremptory challenge. And we'll talk about the skills of questioning that are involved when you're trying to lead a juror to a position where you would rather that they, in fact, admit that they would not be fair in a case. So, the purpose of jury selection is fair jurors, but when time is short, at least to try to get rid of jurors that are predisposed against you. And you're doing that by having conversations with folks. It would allow you to exercise a educated judgment, to exercise a peremptory challenge, force each side to use up their peremptory challenges so that, in fact, they're left with jurors that presumably, after that, each side has exercised their peremptories to a balanced jury, and also to make sure that, if you can, you don't want to waste your peremptory challenges, you have an unlimited number of challenges for cause based upon a juror's admitting what it is that's going on. All right. Now let's talk about the skills. Now the first thing is getting started. Now here again, the judge will have done a fair amount of the work in the typical setting. The judge will have asked the jurors whether or not they know any of the parties. They'll have asked whether they know any of the lawyers in the case, whether they'll know any of the important witnesses that are going to testify or any of the witnesses at all. And so there will be this, do you know any of these parties? Presumably, if you know these individuals, they could be a reason to keep you off. After that, the judge often will let counsel, if they've given them permission to go ahead and address the jury, to go ahead and stand around and address the jury. And what you'll have to see is that how the judge sets up the voir dire often can vary. Sometimes what you have is you have a courtroom that has about 40 jurors in it. You seat 12, you talk to the 12. As folks get excused, then other people come and they fill their places until the peremptories have been used up and everybody is satisfied. Or, in addition, what you can have is you can have a situation where everybody is sitting in one place and you're having a conversation to the group, to the large group as a whole, and you're trying to include prospective folks into the conversation one at a time. Sometimes the way it works is you have a voir dire on an individual juror, and you satisfy each side about that, and then you move on to the next one. That technique is a very, very labor process, and there's a whole lot of concern about whether everybody else is bored by your individual conversations with the jurors, and therefore often that is not a technique that you see too much, but you could have an individual jury voir dire person by person. When you stand then, if you assume the usual process, which is that you have a group of folks sitting in the box and then a group of people who are sitting out in the audience, and you're going to ask questions to them, you should explain what jury voir dire is and tell them, in a sense, this is the time to talk to you to find out whether or not you're the right jurors for this case. Now, it's important for them not to see that you're casting moral judgment on them if you excuse them. It's just that, and you could give them examples about this, that in fact, if you've just been through a divorce, maybe you're not the right person to sit on a divorce case. That if you've just lost a loved one, then maybe you're not in a position to be the best person in a wrongful death case. If you've just had a problem with a police officer and a false arrest, then you probably wouldn't be the right person to sit in a case where the police's judgment in arresting is a person is at issue. And so the description of and giving examples of the kinds of experiences jurors may have in a kind of a generic case is a way that often that lawyers will get started with the voir dire. And you're trying to establish good eye contact with the people in the voir dire. You should take a pace that's open and friendly, that's conversational. And what you're trying to do is to say to them, we're looking for fairness. We want you to, in a sense, put yourself into the shoes of my client and ask yourself, this is the overall purpose. Could I be fair to him, or am I predisposed, based on who I am, to really not be fair to that individual based upon their characteristics? And that's where you're headed in this, and your opening conversation then describes what jury selection is. Now, one of the things that's interesting about jury selection is that you want people to open up. And obviously the best way to get them to open up is to ask them open-ended questions. Tell me about yourself. Tell me about your job. Describe to me where you work. Tell me what it is that you do day to day. Open-ended questions with jurors are ways to get them to talk. The problem is that as you're getting them comfortable and having a conversation with them, one of the things that you've got to be careful about is that everybody gets included fairly quickly. Otherwise, what will happen is that there is a potential for boredom to set in, or people feel excluded. You're very interested in having this conversation with this one juror, and you're less interested in them, and they feel slighted. And so very quickly, what you want to do is, by asking open-ended questions, is to engage the group in a whole. Now, where time is limited, after you do some beginning kinds of tell me about yourself questions, if the court gives you that, then you want to move very quickly into kinds of questions which are trying to get at those experiences again that may occur to jurors that would make them predisposed against you. Now, do you see the dilemma here? The dilemma is that if you ask a question like, have you ever had an experience with a police officer, or somebody you know had an experience with a police officer, or you believe the police officer was not playing fair? If you ask a question like that, then the potential is that the rest of the jury veneer gets polluted by the answer that is given. That the argument that is, be careful of the pollution argument is to be careful about the kinds of questions that you're asking and the amount of discussion that you're getting from the jurors, because, in fact, it may affect the rest of the jurors to see the case that way. Now, you're going to hear different advice about this. Frankly, I think that the advice of pollution against pollution is overstated. It does seem to me that all the jurors, as they listen to it, what you do is you develop that experience, the person is asked questions about, it sounds to me like that experience is very fresh to you, that it'd be very difficult to put that experience aside. You agree with me that it would be difficult for you to judge this case based on the facts presented in the case without importing in your own experience into the setting. That in that situation, that if the person agrees with you about that and they're excused for cause, that there's an education that occurs to the jurors that overrides the pollution, the potential pollution effect. On the other hand, there are, of course, situations where if a person is describing spouse abuse or if a person is describing a very tragic situation where there will be sympathy. And, of course, exercise your judgment as to whether or not, in fact, you might want to talk about it in private. One of the things you should know is that you can choose, if you see that the juror is having difficulty, to say, would you like to talk about this in private? And to invite that as a way of understanding more about the experience, perhaps making a judgment about challenge for cause without having this overall pollution effect on the jurors. My view, for what it's worth, is that better to find out about that experience, to find out how deeply it's held, and not worry so much about the effect on the rest if what you can do is to show by your questioning that, in fact, it's not fair for that person to be sitting on the juror. Then the educational effect presumably overwhelms the pollution effect that might otherwise occur. And again, for what it's worth, also my view is that if you can get people to talk about race issues and prejudice issues, that, in fact, the education effect of getting people to recognize that it's difficult for them to be fair with those kinds of attitudes and views will teach the rest of the jurors as to how it is that they should behave, and that the pollution effect is overblown. Better to find out about it as opposed to not find out about it. Now, how do you find out about questions of race? Obviously, talking about attitudes towards busing, about where their kids go to school, can give you some general feel. when you have a race issue, when you have a defendant that you're representing that is a minority member of a community and you want and worry about the race issues, one of the things to do is to really get some consultation and some help. You want to find out how do people feel. You want to find out what kinds of questions will give the most socially acceptable way into people talking about their attitudes and their perceptions. And that is something that involves good expertise of people that are out there that will help you with that. But part of what you're doing is asking them to describe their experiences, to go deep, to tell you more about those experiences, and then make a judgment about whether or not you want to take it to a challenge to cause or whether you want to stop the conversation and at least take them into a peremptory challenge and have them excused. So you have group conversations. You're asking open-ended questions. You're following up to try to get more information and more detail. Once you get enough information, what you're wanting to do is to make the decision about whether or not you're going to take them to a peremptory challenge. Your view about peremptory challenges, when you want the opponent to waste one, you've heard an experience that the person has that's predisposed for you, one of the things that you can do is to lead in a way that rehabilitates that juror. And the way that you lead to rehabilitate the jury is to say, despite that experience, I'm sure you could still put that aside and try this case based upon the evidence that's presented in this case. Am I right? You could still be fair, don't you think, based upon hearing all the evidence in the case. And that technique, a leading question that leads them to a fairness position, will force your opponent to use a peremptory. Judges often jump in order to be able to rehabilitate a juror if the judge is in the room because they want to move it along and they want you to exercise your peremptory so that you're back into a position where you're stuck with the jurors that are there. But you can use those same techniques when you try to put on the other side option for exercising a peremptory challenge. If you want to lead somebody to a challenge for cause, similarly, your open-ended questions will change and will move into a leading question format. So having had that experience of having a sister who's been abused as a spouse and you saw the tragedy that she went through, and I take it that that's an experience that still is fresh. It's one that still makes you angry. You still probably have some strong feelings, don't you, about the situation that your sister was forced to suffer through. And I would imagine it'd be hard to put those aside in judging this case and deciding whether or not, in fact, there was abuse that was going on in this case. And if you get yeses to those leading questions, then you're in a position to exercise a challenge for cause, to ask the juror to be excused. Now, there's a whole technique about when do you exercise the challenges for cause? Do you exercise them immediately? Do you save them up within the group and the panel? You need to ask the judge and the court as to how they're dealing with the questions of when do you exercise your peremptory challenges and when you exercise your challenges for cause. You can see that what this does is it creates a record-keeping nightmare for a single trial lawyer. To have in front of you a group of people, you're trying to keep their answers straight, you're trying to remember who, what their names are, if you get to know their names or you're just referring to them by jurors 1, 2, 3, and 4, and then that changes. You've got occupations, you've got information about their likes and dislikes, and keeping that track of that is a record-keeping nightmare. You want to make sure you have note-taking materials in front of you with the box, with jurors as they go in, for you to be able to take notes and scratch out if people are excused in order to be able to keep track of what's going on, or to ask an associate to help you in that record-keeping. Often, lawyers today, when the cases are significant enough that and the resources are there to go ahead and do it, you may have people in the room, psychologists who you're consulting with to help you make the decisions. So the skills of jury selection are, frankly, making an opening presentation about what jury selection is. Number two, its ability to ask open-ended questions, both of individuals, but to the group as a whole, that as you get information about your jurors that you want to follow up, to go deep, to get more detail, to find out more about those experiences. And then similarly then, to make a decision about peremptories or challenges for cause or whether or not you believe the person is fair and whether or not you've got enough to feel confident that they're at least in the midway point with you and move on. One last word. Where do you get the information? Where do you get the topics to ask the jurors about your case to find out the experiences they may have? Well, this is, there's nothing, no substitute for you're looking at your case from the perspective of people in the community and thinking, what experiences might they have that could make them predisposed against my client? So issues of race, differences in class, experiences that people may have had that have strong emotional appeal could predispose them one way or the other. Differences in gender, education level, differences in ways that people see the world, people who are in basically a belief that they control their environment, and in fact things then that happen are somebody else's fault if they're controlling their environment, or people who really think that life is not very easily controlled. You will find that jurors, consultants say there are basically two types of people in the world, and you've heard about this before, A types and B types, and the A types that are control freaks, they're the ones that you want if you're the prosecution, and they're the ones that you want if you're the defendant, because obviously then it's somebody else's fault if something bad happens, and you can control yourself. If you can control your environment, then it's likely that the plaintiff is contributorily negligent. And then there are the B types, who worry much more that life happens to them, and they're more the kind of the stereotypical bleeding heart liberals who are overly sympathetic to the sad story of an individual and what it is that's happened to them. There are all kinds of theories and all kinds of stereotypes, and you want to canvas broadly, asking yourself basically, what are those experiences and what is the profile of the juror who would be predisposed against me, or what kinds of experiences may be in play that could predispose a juror for me, especially if we've got the resources to sort that out. And having an analysis of those key topics that you want to talk about, the techniques are group interviewing. So some ideas about skills, public presentation, open-ended questions, follow-ups, and then leading questions to exercise challenges for cause and peremptory challenges.
Wow.
Wow.
Wow, wow, wow. Great wow. Job.
Yeah, way to go, prof.
I learned so much.
Yeah. Leading questions to establish cause.
I mean, what do you want? Do you want to win or lose?
You want to win. Yeah.
So then the next question is, who are you?
Who am I?
Are you a winner or a loser?
It takes brass balls to sell real estate. Have you ever been a part of Wadir, Steve?
Wadir?
Mm-hmm.
No, what's that?
That was the whole lecture was about voir dire, the jury selection process.
Oh.
Wait, what is? I mean, you come from a place where many people speak French. What does that mean to the truth of saying?
Voir dire?
Yeah.
Oh, it means like must say.
Must say?
Or bound to say.
Okay.
It kind of makes sense.
I mean, I wasn't saying it didn't make sense.
No. I mean, just like some of
these things do.
some of the times they really don't.
Yeah.
No, but V-A-U-X or V-A-U-T-D-A-R-I. No.
V-O-I-R. Voir.
Oh, voir dire.
Yeah.
Oh, seeing and saying.
Seeing and saying, okay. But is voir also the truth or something?
No.
Okay.
Voir is to see.
Okay. So to see and to say.
But devoir is like a duty.
Okay.
So like the of seeing is a duty. But seeing is just like looking at it. So
here on the talking show, we just dire.
Yeah. Seulement, nous disons. Well, we don't though, because we don't dire. You would have to conjugate it. Je dis, tu dis.
Okay.
Il, elle, dise.
We talk.
Yeah. Nous disons.
We say.
Nous disons. Yeah. Like we say.
Okay.
Yeah. Nous disons. I'm fascinated by this because I feel like as a non-American, this year they tried to call me up for jury duty and then I told them, you know, not an American citizen. And that basically excludes you from jury duty. But
I see.
They send, well, and to be fair, it's the truth. Like there was a big marker on the thing saying, like, if you are not a citizen and
they suggest the boxes you should check.
Well, they also tell you that if you claim to be able to sit on a jury when you can't legally,
you're toast.
Yeah. So, and I don't want to be toast. So I told them I'm not an American citizen and they told me I didn't have to go to jury duty, but I lived in Canada for like 28 years before moving around a lot.
And you were never called for jury duty?
I was never once called.
Okay.
And I came back and spent another chunk of my 30s in Canada, and they never called me. And living here, they've never called me. And to be fair, like, I can't go if they call me.
Mm-hmm.
But there's nothing stopping them. Like, I am a permanent resident. Like, I do show up as living in the neighborhood, so they could call me.
Mm-hmm.
But they just never do.
Mm-hmm.
And meanwhile, like, as long as Meredith and I have been together, she's been called up at least once or twice a year.
Oh, yeah. They can only call you once a year, but unless you defer or something.
Yeah, maybe that's it. Like, she, like, said, like, no, not this time, and then they called her in the summer or something.
She seems like she'd be quite adept at getting out of it.
She'd also make a great juror.
Right.
Let's be honest. Fairest person in the world.
Yeah.
Except when it comes to herself. Dun, dun, dun. But no, like, the most fair.
Well, you have to sacrifice the self to even be a juror.
It's apparently true. You have to be nothing. You're just like a tube, and the facts just move through you.
Right. This thing, the law, makes you a subject, and in order to enact it, you must be subjectless.
You know, I feel like...
it's actually an incredible proposal.
It's like a very Adorno move.
Yeah, exactly.
That's like some deep negative dialectic style shit.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The precise thing that makes you into the thing is the thing you must undo to be the full thing.
Dun, dun, dun. No, but fair enough.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well.
Well, I wonder what happened with that German goalkeeper. I'm not sure if all of you know this. It was like one of the goalies for, like, you know, FC Mandelbach or something. They lost a match 42-0 and he was arrested. according to the article, the police had some questions about the game.
I feel like if you lose that badly and you haven't generally been losing that badly, it's very suspicious.
Yeah, and there was one bet placed that your team would lose by more than 40 goals or something. And the odds were through the roof.
And then you get everything. Yeah, you win the bet. Yeah, exactly.
It turns out the only bet was placed by your nephew or something.
Yeah, your mom.
Your girlfriend.
Yeah, I mean, stranger things happen.
Yeah, it's true.
It must be something like that. Otherwise, like, how could we possibly?
Mm-hmm.
Alternatively, I think that his defense is really good. It's just like, but say goodbye to ever playing soccer or football again. Yeah. It's just to be like, I fucking suck, dudes.
It's also a team sport, though. I mean, like, the defense didn't go on trial.
Yeah, it's like, I let in 48 goals, but, like, I was let down by my defense, and I'm like,
oh, that's an amazing joke. He goes to trial, and he's like, I brought my defense. It's just like three guys in soccer uniforms.
Yeah, this is my defense.
This is my defense.
They failed.
Yeah. Oh, wait, you said I could bring my defense. I don't understand. Oh, jeez.
How's your knee?
How's my knee? Oh, yeah. It's feeling better. It's still
big.
Like, 2 weeks later, like my shin is yellow with bruise.
Oh, no.
But I think next Sunday I could play soccer.
Oh, that's cool. Well, I wish you the best.
Yeah. Sativa FC is just about to clinch the title.
Oh, sick.
Yeah.
When's the final game? When do you know?
This Sunday's last game of the season, so whether or not we clinch first heading into playoffs.
Oh, well, tell our listeners where they can go watch you compete.
Normally at Via Parque in Pasadena at 5 p.m. or 4 p.m. You have to check the Sativa Football Club Instagram account around Saturday.
Check that account.
To know the game, but it'll definitely be this Sunday. And we're playing Flurry, who is a very difficult opponent.
Oh, dear.
Mm-hmm.
Well...
polite, but difficult.
And you won't be playing anyway.
No, I'm going to the Central Coast with my girlfriend for our anniversary.
Oh, well, that's delightful.
Mm-hmm.
previously celebrated on the talking show as well.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, what joy.
Yep. Good morning, Chinatown.
Good morning.